Michael Bond has now published 3 books with us, starting with 22 Skidoo, and then Cosmographia, and 20... I don't know, there was a print of printing Skidoo. Okay. 22 Skidoo. Followed by Great Canadian Poems. And this fall, this fall comes City Part 1, of which there are 3 parts. Part 1 comes this fall. Michael Bond has the distinct pleasure of being the only book talk author to have typos on the covers of all his books. Yay! And he's the only book talk author to have been involved with 2 major awards. The Governor General's Award, which he lost. And the Friggin Prize, which he won. So, please welcome Michael Bond.
And there are in fact, it's often forgotten that there are in fact 4 books, because this book is a flip book. And it has on one side 22 Skidoo. See, this there was in fact a typo in this. We decided to award me a prize to hide the typo. And people think it's a real prize, which is great. You know, people, wow, you got the friggin' award. Wow. The slogan of the friggin' award was no long list, no short list, no guest list, just the friggin' prize. Maybe I will. Yeah. Okay, I'll read a poem from 22 Skidoo. It's called Golly. I wrote these poems when my daughter was quite young and she was acquiring language, and I was trying to make sure she had lots of good words apart from all the other stuff. So I was teaching her these words, golly. And it has an epigraph by Katharine Hepburn. Golly. That's from the Philadelphia story. Golly, it's swell to canoodle.
Wait, I published that?
I never in my life thought I would write those lines, ever. Golly, it's swell to canoodle surpasses skedaddle's oomph in lost appeal to delight's distant dream of approvals, persuasive dialectics, a smackaroo to beat the band, but not up there, as Golly gives us in Kate's breathless surprise, another unknown origin, pulling us neither there nor there, but and as it piles on, showdowns and oodles headed nowhere fast and not afraid of any thyroids, ineffable fluctuations in the image of wagon's mode of transport imprints on coots, death of berry pickings, augmented pain in the tush. Golly. And this is from the other side of the book is called Subtractions, Opus Minus One. And how about 7 a.m. hockey arena minus one. To speak of moon slivers is impossible without vaporous words, suspended nuance skittering smoothly over too many blue lines to satisfy laws, regulated increments of blistering space or lost phases to come. There is a game, and then there is a game, a question of consonantal drift from the lips into throat's growl, plosive, I think, they call peas, round, black, arc, across white ices, challenge to bees, black hole. What coagulates in motion, falling and rising across positions, lost intent, shattering empires of best laid remedial compositions in extended ice aches. All those possible lines of emerging attention from tangled legs and sticks, recollects treasure islands, apple barrel revelations, a question of falling or snoozing your way out of hooscow destiny's claim on deflections, sudden promised outcomes, surprised delight. Stumbling into history's miraculous rebirth after premature ejaculations of game's end slides out of the corner, crease shimmering in fog of clashing weathers leaves independence in the dust of the chase. From the clouds, mercurial sheep flow in lines of flight no mind can guess before arrivals, magnetic future claims place beyond it already as clumps of girls glide through breathless distances, warped bursts of unmarketable testimonial to leafy eruptions into cold, wet dawn. My daughter's a hockey player, so I've spent a lot of time in arenas. She was very young when I wrote that poem, and the girls, it was like, they look like sheep on the ice, right? Like herds of sheep, they follow the puck, like this mass of girls, they go around the ice, and it's hilarious. Hockey. Soon the men will be in Sochi, and the real Olympics will begin. Did you read John Doyle this morning? He's got this whole thing about Sochi as a fairy tale where we send our maids and maidens off to a land run by an ogre in order to win the gold and silver and bring it back home again. And he says, in the beginning, it's these winsome maids and young men, and soon the warriors will come once the male hockey starts. This is Cosmographia. Someone attempted to call it a long poem last Friday, and I insisted that it was not a long poem. It was a post-Lucretian faux microepic. No. Yes. So I only get to read one of these. It's hard to pick. I love them all. They're all like your children, right? I used to read, when I was writing these, it was just terrific because I was, Victor and David Anderson and I were getting together once a week, and Victor was writing Troubadours, I think, at the time. And we get together and have a few beers and read the newest poems to each other. And it was wonderful. So this is book 10, and it's called, so it's an epic, right? And there's a journey and you're trying to get home, and there's all these cows who are confusing things and messing up the trail. And then we get to book 10, and there's these unexpected rest stops. And this one is called Shangri-La, Canto 58. Somehow, we always knew the mountains held secrets. The average trip to school still saw them. Valleys appear out of the mist of the secrets or through hidden tunnels. Somehow we always knew the mountains held tunnels and that valleys would wait at the end. Though the tents may vary, the waiting remains in frosty air, a cloud of breath hovering. Average trips to school still saw them around the sky. They were hovering, and the valleys waited for someone they always knew would come. Somehow the guide gets there as you always knew she would. Then the valley trembles slightly just on the other side. The hovering breath remains a kind of promise. Once there, frosty air absconds with the tunnel. Once there, the tunnel is in the mountains, and the average trip to school hovers somewhere else. Somehow, valleys that hovered in the frosty air always knew you would come, though waiting was necessary, as if the promise was a tunnel cut through the ice and the secrets glittered within. Then the ice gives way and the secrets scatter. Old before their time is the risk of secrets in frosty tunnels. It always seems to crumble before the tunnel arrives. This is a secret, and then the pieces blow away. Gusts of frost in the frigid promise valleys sometimes make. Outside arrives, and the pieces hover in tunnels. Somehow we always knew gusting secrets would scatter before the tunnels got there. Hovering in frigid air, the average trip to school knew secrets would remain even as the pieces blew away and the tunnels' horizons scattered past any thought of the way there beyond the mountains. Somehow we always hovered and knew that the way there was no different. The cold air, the tunnels, the mountains, somehow we always knew the way there was different. There was a lot of American material in this poem because good epics always have wars in them, and the war that was going on at that time was the American attack on Iraq. So I wanted to come back to my Canadian, I guess you can't call them roots, but I wanted to come back to Canada. I had this moment of realizing I still teach. They still allow me to teach, miraculously. And my students, I realized at some point that, I know you're smiling, Brad, but it's true, you barely know who Foster Hewitt was, right? Like, my students don't know anything about the Canada that I entered into at 20 years of age and fell in love with. And so I decided to write Great Canadian Poems for the Aged, Volume 1, Illustrated Edition. And I actually managed to get a blurb from Northrop Frye. It wasn't easy. I had some help from Brad. He went into the next dimension and had a little chat with Nori. Nori says, "This is not great literature." And this poem is called, For Those of You of a Certain Age, Ladies and Escorts. It even has a picture. It is an illustrated edition. So when I came here, if you went into a pub, like, there was the gentleman's entrance and there was the ladies and escorts entrance. And you weren't to cross the line. Like that, John Calvin would roll over in his grave if you crossed from the gentleman's side to the ladies and escort side. The windows were all blacked out. And they were all blacked out. God. Ladies and escorts. Sounds like some translation of operational imagery, working crowds known to gather potential formulations of sex-saturated icons of hotter-than-normal posturing. The other door limits onanistic intrusions to entrances acceptable to lingering Calvin formations and orange aggregates parading around three sheets to operational story, keeping output already bound to rules conducting charged flows into arenas of non-profligate outcomes, buzzes with ulronic distribution catechisms, the root of all co-evil suggestions of compromised integrity and fluttering angels among sticky shadows and year-long Boxing Day sales, hovers and swirls rising in the air, leaving distinctions meant to solidify in and out into potential grounds for divorce of implicate incandescence adrift. Wanting it has no terminus in it, no matter how exposed machinic resolutions of customer complaints check off their satisfaction. Pushing it is another matter if you look aslant at the way of its firm but tender instance, pushing it leads to moments of extreme entrances. Oops. And lucid trees, red maple, columnar oak, golden chain, cypress, you name it. Then ladies and escorts will commingle in the great democracy of elements as foretold in certain imaginary texts attributed to excited outbursts of outlandish impertinence. Then Jerusalem and Albion will have whatever doors they want, and Arcadia will knock around the same streets. Hot tacos and cold beer have been known to define in terms prattling children's propensity for moments of revelation lay bare in light of Thoreau's morning sun across asphalt assertions, sometimes mistaken by subject positions for the end. Thank you.